This is a CBC podcast. If you like Q, the podcast with Gian Gomeshi, you'll love QTV, featuring full-length interviews with personalities from the world of arts and culture. Subscribe to Q's video podcast at cbc.ca/podcasting.
Hello, and welcome to the Vinyl Cafe podcast. I'm Vinyl Cafe producer, Jess Milton. Today, we have three excerpts from this week's show, starting with Stuart talking about spring.
The ice was off the pond last weekend. The water brackish and brown and windswept. A sign of spring for sure, but a chilly sort of sign, a harbinger more than a hint of things to come. On Sunday, we went walking, and everyone and everything seemed to be softening. There was damp, dark mud where the sun was hitting the road, and the dog got covered in burrs. On Monday, we got out of bed cautiously and peered through the blinds, and the sky was blue and the sun reassuringly bright, but the pond was frozen over again, just a skim of ice. From the upstairs window, it looked as if it would have crackled wonderfully if we could have stomped across it, like the fragile ice that comes overnight on October puddles. But our galoshes aren't high enough for the pond, and anyway, up close, we found it to be thicker than we had expected, and blacker, more January than June, lots of little brown leaves and other wintry moments caught in its iciness. We tried to snap a piece from the edge, and it came easily enough, bringing to mind those phony glass panes that they break over cowboys' heads in the movies. At lunch on Tuesday, standing in the gravel lane and talking to the roofer who had come to repair the wreck of this winter, and listening to the crows complaining, we heard the noon bell on the fire hall tower for the first time in months. Not because it hasn't been ringing, we knew, but because we haven't been out there to hear it. Early April. One day summer, one day winter, a year of weather packed into a month. The month that shuffles its feet on your stoop like a young man clutching a bouquet behind his back. And all the young girl wants to say is, get over yourself and give me the flowers. But she stands there patiently like little you and me, the burr-covered dog wagging his tail by our side, while the ice melts and freezes. All of us standing and waiting for the moment the young man finally leans toward her. All of us praying for the kiss.
That was Stuart McLean, and that was from this week's Vinyl Cafe. Here he is again with a script about prime ministers.
So, I was sitting at the dining room table the other day with a pad of paper in front of me and not much on my mind, a not uncommon state of affairs, when I was seized by an impulse to see if I could write down the name of every Canadian prime minister since the thing began, in order, without looking any up, a test of my political IQ. This is the sort of thing that writers do to fill in the gaps between writing. Although, granted, I would still technically be writing and still trying to create something from nothing, although in this case, rather than my imagination, the nothing would be the vast, vacant field of my field of knowledge. Anyway, I decided to start where I used to tell my students to start, at the beginning. Do it in order, first things first. Well, the first was easy. Sir John A. Macdonald, the man who imagined Canada into existence, the foremost father of Confederation. I wrote his name with a flourish and a flush of satisfaction, and then I stopped dead. Who was number two? I had a sense it was someone from Quebec. Could it have been Cartier? Was George Etienne Cartier ever prime minister? I have to admit, I wasn't sure. Someone did come second, I knew that. And then, as everyone knows, after a brief hiccup, Macdonald was back, winning an unconscionable number of consecutive majority governments, concluding with a campaign of 1891 when his delightful slogan that so defies these times was the old flag, the old policy, and the old leader. You've got to love it. Ah, Sir John. I left a space for number two, and I wrote Macdonald again. So far, I had John A. McDonald and John A. McDonald, and I decided it might be better to work backwards, or better, perhaps, forwards from a more familiar era. Start when I came into the world, cover the known ground. I vaguely wondered how much space I should leave blank between McDonald and my entry on the scene, which was slightly before John Diefenbaker was elected, which meant what exactly? It meant either Mackenzie King or Louis Saint Laurent was prime minister, and surely I should have known the answer to that one, but I didn't. I went with Saint Laurent, and then I jumped to Diefenbaker, and I took my list through Pearson to Trudeau and all the way to Harper, successfully navigating my way through the tricky waters of Joe Clark's 9 months, Kim Campbell's 4 months, and John Turner's 2.5-month term. All modest tenures, but not record-breaking, and more on that in a moment. Now, including King and Saint Laurent, I had 13 names on my list and no idea how many I needed for a full house. The answer to that, I can now tell you, is 22 in all, which is, incidentally, precisely half the number of presidents I'd need on my list if I was doing this in, say, Fargo, North Dakota. And that was a sly shout-out to everyone listening on KDSU. I didn't get all 22, by the way. When I finally gave up the ghost, I had 16 prime ministers on my list, missing 6, including, and I'm not too fussed about this, the unknown 4 who followed McDonald's second term, none of whom were elected. They kept being appointed and then dying off or resigning, they being Sir John Abbott, Sir John Thompson, Sir Mackenzie Bowell, who I don't think I'd even heard of before, and Sir Charles Tupper, who you'd think I would have gotten, he being at 74 the oldest person to have ever become Prime Minister, and the shortest serving at 69 days. He never even met Parliament. I also missed the man who followed MacDonald's first term, our second Prime Minister, to wit, Alexander Mackenzie. A stonemason by trade, a common man, who attained an uncommonly high rank for those times and who built buildings that still stand in Canada. It was Mackenzie who introduced the secret ballot and, led by his common touch, 3 times refused a knighthood. He's the only prime minister of the first 8 who was not knighted. The other one I missed was Robert Borden, who I don't think would ever be my favorite, though I did get Arthur Meehan, who barely held office long enough to clear his throat, and who Senator Eugene Forsey thought could have been the greatest prime minister in history. My favorite is still Pearson, because of his decent modesty, and because the Nobel Committee believed it was him and his pals from the then Department of External Affairs who managed to deflect the intemperate British march towards World War III when the Suez conflict was bubbling. To me, Pearson represents the best of Canada, though full disclosure, he was prime minister when my political eyes were opening, imprint could be at work here, and though Pearson is my emotional favorite, I recognize Laurier, Canada's first French-speaking leader, deserves careful consideration, and concede that many of my generation, most perhaps, would lay claim to that icy magician, Pierre Trudeau. And of course, to end neatly where we began, there is that old scallywag, John A. MacDonald. He was a great man, no doubt about that. Machiavelli said a great man can't be a good man. Actually, he said it the other way around. And I don't know anything about MacDonald's goodness, though I do know he did spawn a good number of good stories. My favorite, I guess, though you have to wonder if it's apocryphal, is the one that has the old whiskey hound tottering off a stage in the middle of a debate to throw up, and then stagger back just as his opponent was finishing, just when it was his turn to be introduced, whereupon he brushed himself off and began, and I quote, "Ladies and gentlemen, every time I hear that man speak, it makes me sick." Would they all be so boisterous, or at least dreamy?
That was Stuart McLean, and that's from this week's Vinyl Cafe. We have one more script now. Here's Stuart.
I began the show today talking about spring. I thought it might be nice to end the same way. I spotted another sure sign of spring the other day on my way home from work at the corner of Queen and Spadina. It was Jason Ford, 39 years old. Jason's been making his living on the streets of Toronto for a decade now, balancing stones and construction bricks one atop the other into gravity-defying statues. When people see Jason's junkyard art for the first time, a brick perched on top of a rock with another brick resting precariously on top of both, most people assume he's using glue or that the pieces are held in place by a steel rod running through their center. Well, he doesn't, and they aren't. And when people figure that out, enough of them are moved enough to reach for spare change that it makes the rock balancing worth Jason's while. Not that he needs a lot of spare change, or has for the most part of the last decade anyway. Jason took a vow of poverty years ago and tried to make sure at the end of each month that his bank balance was zero, which meant if he had any money left over after feeding himself and paying his rent, he'd either spend it or give it away. In fact, he tried to keep no money around all the time, which meant when he got up in the morning and wanted coffee, he'd have to go out and balance rocks. It's not that he has anything against money, it's just, well, it's just I'm not sure exactly, because I'd never spoken to him before this week, and anyway, he's not like that anymore. He has kids now, two of them, and now that his eldest daughter is 14, he has more responsibilities. But he's still balancing, and I've always wanted to talk to him about what he does, so when I saw him standing there, I asked him if he'd join me for a coffee. It seemed as good a way as any to welcome this spring. Jason says the last 10 years have been amazing for him. He says if you go out onto a street corner two or three times a week for a decade, you see amazing things. He says even the animals stop and watch him. The pigeons and the squirrels and the sparrows. At first, he says, they'll watch from the wires, but after he's been at a location for a while, they'll eventually feel comfortable enough that they'll sit right on the statues or even, sometimes, on him. Jason likes to think of his rock statues as acupuncture needles, and that doing his work is like doing acupuncture on the city. He thinks of Queen Street as the body of the city, Kensington Market as the heart, and the annex neighborhood where the university is as the mind. He works in all three neighborhoods. He says when he walks around town, he likes to imagine that he's walking through a giant labyrinth. And he likes to think that his balancing stones add to that labyrinth quality for others. He wants them to shock people, not a shock of terror or fear, mind you, but a shock of beauty, a shock that might provoke some sort of understanding or insight or transformation. Which does happen, he says, from time to time, maybe even a couple of times a year. Someone will come across his statues and the balancing stones will play with their idea of balance. The balance of their life, their relationship, their job. There was a woman once, he told me, who came upon him and stared at the statues for hours and then came back after a few weeks and said the rocks had changed everything for her. She had changed her job and she had come out of the closet. His statues had been like an opening door. I have been wonderfully surprised, he told me, by how open people are, and how kind, too. I've seen police officers coming up to me, and I thought, oh man, I'm in trouble now. And then they look at what I'm doing, and they say, balance and harmony. We need more of that. And then he looked at me. Do you know what time it is, he said? I'm applying to get into acupuncture school. I don't want to be late. Jason had been holding a set of prayer beads discreetly under the table all the while we talked, and I was just about to ask him about the prayer beads and about his daughter. What, I was wondering, would a teenage girl have to say about her father working on the street like he does? But he was standing now, so I stood too, both of us slightly off balance, and we shook hands, and I watched him leave. And I should tell you that Jason, the rock balancer, has a show opening this weekend, and not on a street corner. It's at the City Art Gallery at, okay, well, it's at the corner of Queen and Sherbourne in Toronto, but you know what I mean. It'll be up for a month, and there'll be some balances there, And Jason will be selling some photos of his work, too. But if you don't live in Toronto, you can visit his website and download the photos for free. If you want to visit his website, well, we posted a link to his site on our site. So you just go to vinylcafe.com and you can get there that way. And while you are there at vinylcafe.com, you can find out about a show that we have coming up too. We'll be in Bracebridge, Ontario in a few weeks. We'll be at the brand new Reen M. Case Memorial Theatre in Bracebridge, Ontario on May the 1st and 2nd. And we'd love to see you there. We'll be doing a recording of a couple of Vinyl Cafe shows. You can find out more about that show and about Jason's at vinylcafe.com. Well, that's all the time we have for today's show. Thanks this week to Anton Zabo for the technical assistance. David Amers, the founding producer of the Vinyl Cafe. Louise Curtis is the production assistant. Julie Penner is the music producer. Meg Masters is the long-suffering story editor. The Vinyl Cafe is produced by Jess Milton. I'm Stuart McLean.
And that's where he's supposed to say, so long for now.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.